In the first collection is a poem by Robert Graves that had never been published before, because he had kept it out. And it's just called November the 11th. And some time ago I edited Graves' letters, and this is a poem in a letter to his friend Eddie Marsh, who edited the Georgian poetry anthologies. And when he wrote it, his father, who was his father-in-law, William Nicholson, who was a well-known painter and the father of Ben Nicholson, persuaded him not to publish it. He said he thought it was unworthy of that moment. And I suspect he also thought that it was not going to help Robert, you know, in building a life after the war to write this sort of thing. But he, you know, when armistice was declared, people took to the streets and they were waving flags and cheering and presumably drinking and celebrating in a way that doesn't sound unreasonable.
Yeah.
And so May Wedderburn Cannon in Paris is part of that. She describes in some poems scenes on the streets in Paris, and she's part of that. She's clearly out there celebrating, and she's a young girl, and she's, you know, she's loving it. Graves, at the end of the war, when he heard the war was over, went out walking in the hills in Wales, and, as he put it, couldn't stop crying on the walk. You know, clearly in a different phase. And the people who were waving the flags in the street were the same people who had waved the flags at the beginning of the war. And, you know, he somehow blamed them for clearly a war he felt was unjustified and unnecessary and had been misdirected, and any good intent had, he felt, I think, by that point, been distorted by the changing war aims of politicians who wanted to achieve something else rather than, you know, just a defence of civilization or whatever. So this is a poem he wrote, and he wrote a sort of watered down version, which isn't really very good, which he published in the 1969. But for this, I went back to the original letter because I think it's got more of the flavour of what he really felt. Sorry. So this poem, he's called November the 11th. And it's written like a street ballad because it's describing things in the street. So it's got that rhythm to it. Of, you know. And he says, "Why are they cheering and shouting? What's all the scurry of feet with little boys banging on kettle and can? Wild laughter of girls in the street. Oh, those are the froth of the city, the thoughtless and ignorant scum who hang out the bunting when war is let loose and for victory bang on a drum. But the boys who were killed in the battle, who fought with no rage and no rant, are peacefully sleeping on pallets of mud low down with the worm and the ant." So that shows a sort of, I think a sort of sense of anger and bitterness and despair that he had reached at that point. And it's not dissimilar from, we look at somebody like Vera Brittain, you know, she was a nurse and she wrote two poems really. One was called The Superfluous Woman, you know, and another one, The Lament of the Demobilized. So this is as you left the war, she'd given up, she'd been at Oxford, she gave all that up and she came back, she went back to Oxford and she changed from studying English literature to history because she said she wanted to understand a bit more about the modern world where she said that she wanted to know what had led her generation, and this is her quote, through ignorance to be used, hypnotized and slaughtered. And so she went back to Oxford and she felt very marginalized by that point. There was even a sense that her lecturers thought she might be a bad influence on other students because she would talk about things that they didn't want nice young women to talk about and think about and be worried about. They were almost a bit like Mary Borden. They were still infected when they came back by this sense of bringing the war with them. And for quite a long time, it was not talked about in polite circles to talk about the war. Nobody wanted to know about it. Nobody wanted to talk about it. People weren't interested in it. You kept it to yourself. People wanted to move on. And so this is the poem she wrote at that time, and it's called The Lament of the Demobilized, and it's she's talking to somebody, and we don't know who she's talking to, but she's talking to somebody. But clearly somebody who has got on and didn't go through that experience and who doesn't really understand where she's coming from. And so this is The Lament of the Demobilized. 4 years, some say consolingly. Oh, well, what's that? You're young. And then it must have been a very fine experience for you. And they forget how others stayed behind and just got on. Got on the better since we were away. And we came home and found they had achieved and men revered their names but never mentioned ours. And no one talked heroics now. And we must just go back and start again once more. You threw 4 years into the melting pot, did you indeed? These others cry. Oh well, the more fool you. And we're beginning to agree with them. Really different sort of poem, you know, where you know you get a sense of betrayal that comes through there. And I think quite a common experience. Why don't we talk about Lawrence Minnick?
Yeah, that would be great.
I think one of the interesting figures that I've included, that who has been really marginalised, and it's a very interesting, if we're talking, so we were talking earlier about this whole reception of First World War poetry. The author of the most famous poem of the First World War is now perhaps more marginalised than any other. And that's Lawrence Binyon. Everybody knows those lines, they shall grow not old as we who are left grow old, age shall not weary them nor the years condemn at the going down of the sun, and in the morning we will remember them. Everybody knows that because it's read at every service of remembrance, it's read on Armistice Day and Remembrance Sunday, and it's on lots and lots of war memorials up and down the country, and of course it's inscribed on the entrance to the British Museum. It's carved into stone by Eric Gill in 1920, just as you go into the great doors of the British Museum. And Binyon worked at the British Museum. He started there as soon as he left university, and he worked there for a full 40 years. And he is an interesting person when it comes to authenticity, I think, because that poem that we know him for The Fallen, I say everybody knows it, but probably very few people can say who it's by. Now, he wrote that while he was on holiday in Cornwall, and he read about the retreat from Mons in the Times, in the newspaper, and that was his response. And it's deliberate, and it's and people now think of him as this public poet who wrote these, wrote this very public sort of poetry. And of course, something is going on in those lines, otherwise, we wouldn't be reading them 100 years later. There's something about them. And in that those four lines, he's deliberately searching for a certain rhythm of his language, a certain tone of voice, which reminds us of things like things that people of his generation would have been brought up on: the King James Bible, the Book of Common Prayer, the foundational texts of the Church of England, but also plays of Shakespeare. You can certainly hear some Antony and Cleopatra, I think, in those lines. He's deliberately reaching for that sort of thing because these are the texts that you might reach for at a moment of national crisis. These are the things of which our culture for him is founded.
Mm.
And he's deliberately trying to give consolation, I think, there. Or find consolation. Owen famously said in the preface of his poems, whatever I'm doing is not to provide consolation. I can't provide consolation to anybody reading these poems. Perhaps for future generations, yes, but not for people today. So Binion is writing a poem, clearly strongly felt, but it's a second-hand experience. He's read it in the paper, and he's thinking about it. And then he decides he can't be a bystander in all of this, and he says to himself, I want to be made use of in some way. And so he volunteers for what was called the London Regiment, a form of territorials at that time. And I think first of all he was put behind a machine gun in Holland Park in case anything came over. Of course he sat there not doing very much, and decided that wasn't really what he had in mind. And so he volunteered with the Red Cross and went to France to a small hospital near Verdun, Arcambois, and he became what we would call a hospital porter, and they called a medical orderly. So he's put in uniform, and his job was to carry patients around largely, or lug the furniture up and down, and beds here and there, and but also do other sorts of things, carry the stretchers, unload the ambulances, go to the ambulances on the ambulance train. Sometimes he would help in the operating theatre to hold people down while they were strapped down. Sometimes he had to go out the back and burn a leg that had been amputated. And so it was pretty tough, dirty work for a man who was famous at that time as an art historian. I mean, he was one of the first European experts on Chinese and Japanese art. And so it wasn't his world, wasn't his milieu at all. But he immersed himself in that and became a different sort of poet, really, a different sort of writer. War wasn't his... For someone like Graves wanted to be a famous poet. And to some extent, if you were cynical about it, war was a great subject because people were reading this stuff. And he got published at a very early age because he was writing about what it was like to be in the trenches. Binion was already well known as a poet. He was a famous poet. And he himself would say he was a pretty conventional Victorian. And his was the world of Tennyson and Browning, Swinburne and Houseman. And he's in that tradition of writers. And so it's interesting to see how he responded, because when he was there, he saw what he called maiming and wasting. He saw people really at the harsh end of that, coming off the battlefields near Verdun. And then the British Red Cross also asked him to tour all of their hospitals and canteens in the Western Front. So he spent a month just driving around all the battlefield. And so he saw some pretty horrific things at the end. And so his poetry then becomes quite different. It's much more immediate. It's not that public. It's not meant to be read out in church like For the Fallen. It's not meant to be read out a service of remembrance. And the interesting thing about Binion is that he became a better poet the older he got. And so he's really a poet of the Second World War. And that's when he wrote his best work. about the Blitz in London. But I think he is an interesting figure, because he did recover that sense of authenticity. But it's a different, you know, this is a middle-aged man, a well-established literary figure, a well-established art historian. You know, he's in his 40s. He looks on things with a different perspective. It's not golden youth, you know, sacrificing himself. He's not putting himself in that sort of jeopardy. But he's writing in a different way. And I think there is an interest. It's interesting. He was there.
Mm.
He gave himself, you know, he served as much as he could and responded in a totally different way. So he became, you know, part of his role, I think, in providing solace and comfort. He really befriended a number of the at the hospital he was at, that was for French soldiers. And so he spoke very good French, and he made friends with lots of the patients and helped them. So this is him talking about those patients. And again, I think what comes through is a sense of compassion and humanity. And these were poilus, and they would all be dressed in this ill-fitting, instead of the khaki that the Tommies wore, the poilu, as they were called, the French Tommies, they wore this this blue serge uniform. And it's called the Witnesses. Lads in the loose blue, crutched, with limping feet, with bandaged arm, that roam today the bustling street, you humble us with your gaze, calm, confiding, clear. You humble us with a smile that says nothing but cheer. Our souls are scarred with you. Yet though we suffered all you have suffered, all were vain to atone or to recall the robbed future, or build the maimed body again whole, or ever efface what men have done to men. Each body of straight youth, strong, shapely and marred, shines as out of a cloud of storm and splintered shard, of chaos, torture, blood, fire, thunder, and stench, and the savage shuddering noise of churned and shaken trench echoes through myriad hearts in the dumb lands behind, silent wailing and bitter tears of the world's mind. You stand upon each threshold without complaint. What pen dares to write half the deeds that men have done to men? And so I think that's interesting as well, because you get this sense of humility from Binion. You know, he knows he's not taken part in the fighting. He's not done that. He's not lost an arm. He's not, you know, lost his sight. He's there trying to help these people. And that sense of humanity, that sense of compassion, you know, that's clearly a Victorian poem I've just read. You know, it's not like the modernism you get from something like Rosenberg or Gurney, you know, with that sort of sense of really modern idiom they have. He's writing, as I said, like Tennyson. He's writing that. That's Tennyson going to war. You know, that's what you would have heard. But it seems to me a genuine voice there that comes through, trying to make sense at all. Masefield was in a similar position. In fact, Masefield was at the same hospital with Binion. And although he's in the book, he wrote very few poems about the war, because he says he just couldn't bring himself to write about it. And he found it very difficult to make poetry out of it. And of course, that whole thing of, you know, making art out of that sort of horror is always problematic in that sense.
It's fascinating, isn't it, as well, that the poem that we think of as being that poem of finality, they shall grow not old,
mm.
of being the ending poem.
Yeah.
was actually a beginning poem.
Yeah, right at the September 1914. September the 6th, I think he wrote it. Yeah, it's right at the end, right at the beginning of things, before they'd really kicked off, and he had no idea, first of all, that poem was going to have the impact it had, but no idea that there was going to be the sort of scale of the war. He was just horrified by the first battle.
And that was the biggest thing that had happened.
Yeah.